Welcome to the Side Talk Podcast. Did you like that?
I did.
We on here talk about movies. I'm Rachel Morgan.
I'm Corey Kraft. I just want to say what's up, ding dongs, and shout out all the Corey heads and kittens out there, out there in listener land. This is our third podcast of the day. So why don't we just jump into what we're doing in this episode there, Rachel?
Why not?
All right, let's do it.
Sidewalk home video.
Man, sit your ass down.
Sidewalk home video.
All right.
Yes, it's been a minute.
It sure has.
So this is a bit of a cheat.
Okay.
Because you know me, I usually go try to find the spine of something. And my friend April had a birthday recently, and she said, I want to watch something from the 80s that's kind of fun, but that's not as well known as other things. And I said, well, let's watch Baby Boom. From 1987.
Boom.
I've talked about this film before. I really do enjoy this film, even though Susan Faludi is not on the same page with me on this one. I see her point.
You and Susan deviate on several things, I imagine.
We do. I see her point. Much respect, girl. Much respect. I like this movie, though.
I don't think I've ever seen it, at least not as an adult. I probably saw it in part as a kid.
Well, you know the premise here, right?
Yeah. It's a Charles Shire movie. Diane Keaton's like...
working woman.
Yeah. What if I had a baby along with my high-pressure career?
She accidentally adopts a baby.
Oh, I didn't realize that. How does one do that?
Well, apparently in the 80s, when you have a long-lost relative die and you go to the airport and you can't really understand what the nanny's saying and you're busy because you got to get to a meeting, you just accidentally sign papers and take the baby.
What a blunder.
Sucks. I hate it when you accidentally adopt a baby. Anyway, that happens. And then, of course, antics ensue because you cannot be a working woman in the 1980s and also have a baby.
No.
That is hardcore.
Ridiculous. You think you can have it all? No, ma'am. Sit down. Take several seats, in fact.
Don't worry, though, because it's going to be okay because you're going to move out to Vermont. You're going to start a baby food company called Country Baby. It's going to go viral. This is pre-viral. And you're going to make millions. And you're going to be on the cover of magazines. And you're going to have a montage with flying money.
Well,
it's going to happen.
Her.
Let me tell you some facts about this wonderful film that I highly recommend that you watch. Oh, Nancy Myers. Gotta love ya. First of all, Predator alert. Beep, 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 beep. I feel like we need a sound effect for that.
The Predator from the movie Predator?
In this case, kind of. Chris Noth is one of the tourists. One of his first appearances in a film. One of the tourists that are they're sort of hipsters and that come into one of the little convenience stores or country stores in Vermont and are taking to the Country Baby food. You see him there with some sunglasses on.
And Chris Noth is Mr. Big in Sex and the City and... apparently not a good guy. I guess I missed that.
Yeah, you missed it. Okay, okay, so listen to this cinematic universe. J.C. Wyatt, played by Diane Keaton.
Sure.
J.C. is Diane's name there. Works at the Sloan Curtis Advertising Agency, which is the same exact firm in What Women Want.
Yeah, there you go, Nancy.
From 2000 with Mel Gibson and Helen Hunt, also, of course, directed by Nancy Myers here, who
beloved film.
Wrote Baby Boom.
No problems. No. Every star in that movie, I assume, passes the inspection.
Yep. Nancy Myers loves a.
What a different world, right? What a different world where you could make a high concept comedy that grosses like $100 million at the box office, starring Mel Gibson, and the premise is, ladies sure are a mystery, right, fellas? I mean. Only way you could understand them, I think, is if you could hear what they're thinking up in their brains. Whoa! And that's what happens, of course.
And there are moments where what the women are thinking are, he's so attractive.
Let me slice off a piece of that Mel Gibson there. What a hunk.
Do you think that she got this idea from that, remember that Miracle-Ear commercial? Where it promised you that if you got the miracle ear, you could hear conversations across the room, including ones where they're like, he's so good looking.
Yes, I do remember that.
Okay, anyway, let me continue on with Baby Boom. More importantly, so I don't think you know this. I'm going to hit you with a fact that I don't think you're aware of.
Okay.
There was a short-lived 13-episode TV series called Baby Boom, and I'm about to bring it into a connection between Birmingham, Alabama, and Baby Boom.
Okay.
Can you guess it? Let me give you another hint. from 1980. This very short-lived 13 episode series ran from 1988 to 89, and it starred
Celia Ward,
Birmingham's own Kate Jackson.
Oh, okay.
Altamont High School graduate Kate Jackson.
I did not know about this.
Also a Charlie's Angel, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, this was not her claim to fame because it didn't last long.
R.I.P.
So early in the film, J.C. Wyatt mentions an unseen character named Sheldrake. Uh-huh. And this is going to be one of those things that you like a lot. This is a nod to your boy, Billy Wilder, who assigned that name to different characters in three films, Sunset Boulevard, The Apartment, and Kiss Me Stupid.
Yeah.
So here's a fourth. Love that little nod.
All right.
Sam Shepard and Diane Keaton, by the way, were in Crimes of the Heart together a year earlier in 1986.
I've never seen that. I don't know much about that movie.
I haven't seen it since it came out. This is not an endorsement because I liked a lot of weird shit when I was young, but I did like that film. I remember liking that film as a 12-year-old.
I get that mixed up with Places in the Heart starring Sally Field.
I like Places in the Heart too.
I've never seen that either. But you liked Sally Field.
I love Sally Field.
I mean, who doesn't?
Sally's
right?
My girl.
But I feel like
she's Norma fucking Ray.
You were dialed into Norma Ray as a youngster, and you were dialed into Places
we were
in the Heart
recently
and Smokey and the Bandit and so forth.
I had a Who Killed Karen Silkwood bumper sticker on my car at 16. I liked a lot of stuff. You know? Okay, so anyway, so I would like to go back and watch that, though. I had not heard of this film, though.
Uh-huh.
And they were in this film called The Only Thrill in 1997, and then another film I've never seen called Darling Companion in 2012.
I've seen Darling Companion.
How is that?
Bad.
Ooh.
Darling Companion is
Yikes.
A Lawrence Kasdan movie
that
reunites him with Kevin Kline, and Diane Keaton's in it. And
is it bad movie bad?
No,
or is it just dull?
It's just dull.
Okay.
It's not good. Yeah, I think it's about a missing dog, if I remember correctly. It's not a very good movie.
Well, here's a fun one.
Okay.
One of two role reversal baby films of the 1980s that were top billed by a star with the last name Keaton.
Mr. Mom?
Yep. Diane Keaton and Baby Boom, and of course Michael Keaton and Mr. Mom in 1983. Yeah. Diane Keaton and Michael Keaton have never collaborated or been in a star team film together, despite the Keaton thing that could happen.
Well, neither of them, I don't think that's either of their actual last names, right? Like,
I actually don't know that.
Michael Keaton, his name is Michael Douglas.
Oh, that's right. He had to change it.
There's another. Obvious.
Oh, I meant to tell y'all.
Uh-oh.
I have almost forgotten. This was going to be actually a Slack I was going to send y'all. Off subject. Michael Douglas posted a video of himself on Valentine's Day eating oysters.
Aw. That's great. You love that the spark is still alive.
Let me tell you, it'll never die on this podcast. Michael Douglas and his cunnilingus issues will never die on podcast. I don't care. I'll take that to the very end.
I thought I remembered this, thank you. I wanted to double check that this was correct, and it is. Diane Keaton's actual last name, she shares the last name with her most famous character. Her name is Diane Hall.
Oh.
Isn't that interesting?
Look at that.
Yeah.
And what movie would that be?
Who
would that be
directed? Great Annie Hall.
Okay.
I don't know. Who directed Annie Hall?
Final little fun fact here about Baby Boom, which I know now that you're hearing all this, you're definitely going out to rent.
I mean, I'll get around to it.
I got to tell you, her outfits, the production design of this thing are amazingly 80s. It's worth it just for that. Anyway, halfway through the film, JC, again, of course, played by Diane Keaton, right? Her boss, Fritz, says to her the line, "Something's got to give," which of course is the title of another Nancy Meyers film starring Diane Keaton from 2003.
Yep.
There you go. That is Baby Boom for today, at least.
It's on the watch list. I'll get around to it.
I think you'll enjoy it. It's a breezy little one.
All right.
Kind of fun.
And now a look at what we're watching this week.
So it's been a minute since we've done what we're watching, even.
Yes, but...
And I have seen stuff.
You have seen stuff. We talked about Drive Away Dolls in a previous episode, so
yeah,
we don't
need
to relitigate that.
Wish I hadn't seen that. Ugh, what a bummer. Well, even my soda was kind of was a little off.
Well, that's a shame.
I will tell you that, though, I think maybe the most important thing I can bring you today is to let you know that I have, and it's been a minute since I've seen it, because we haven't we've been a little on hiatus, but I have seen the Zone of Interest.
Yeah, we haven't talked about it. I think we both saw it kind of a little while ago now.
Yeah.
Great movie.
This is the number one film of the year for me. It's the very top of the list. It took me a minute to really wrestle with it compared to so many other great films this year, including Poor Things and of course Killers of the Flower Moon for me. But I ended up with Zone of Interest on the top of my list because I think it's doing a lot. And it is one of those films to me that is absolutely a masterwork.
Yeah.
And it is an important film. And very rarely do I watch a film that haunts me in my sleep.
Yeah.
And I had a real solid night of nightmares after seeing this. I think it's doing something more than just cinematically, if you will. It's working in this particular way that is really, really a psychological mindfuck. And I say that with highest recommendation. Like, I do think Killers of the Flower Moon is an incredibly important film, and actually, I think Poor Things is an important film. I could make an argument for that.
Sure.
But I still think that I think The Zone of Interest is just probably one of the most important films of the last decade.
I agree. I think it's a movie that's going to age super well. It's my number two movie of the year. It's a very, very close number two, though. It's a movie that, despite being, you know, as intense of an experience as it is, it's something that I want to see again, just to sort of poke around with the technique. You know what I mean? Like,
I've seen it twice.
You've seen it twice. Since the first viewing is really overwhelming, I want that second viewing to really be able to dial into what Jonathan Glazer is doing. You know, the cinematography technique is a bit unusual. They had mounted cameras all throughout this set. Let the actors just inhabit this house, live in this house, and removed the cameras that were mounted in post-production. So that's why everything's shot from these sort of locked positions. There's very little camera movement that I can remember. There might be that's very sparsely done. But the cumulative effect between the incredible sound design is really, really powerful. And of course it is, as so many people have mentioned, a sort of examination of the banality of evil, of the people who populate the sort of the machine of death that is,
you know,
the Holocaust and specifically the camp Auschwitz, the most notorious concentration camp.
I have to tell you, I've heard that quote a lot about this film, about the banality of evil.
It's kind of easy to apply.
I actually don't think that's what it is.
Yeah.
I think this film is working on so many other levels other than that. I think that there's something certainly to be said about the banality of evil. I don't think that that's what this film is doing.
It's not entirely what it's doing, and I think that that's kind of a reductive way to talk about it, but it is a sort of examination of how the soul can erode when one is just like compartmentalizing. And human beings apparently have this endless ability to compartmentalize and to view, as the Nazi commandant who is our lead character, Rudolf Hess, who was the actual historical, you know, guy in charge at Auschwitz for a lot of the time, his ability to reduce genocide to a logistical problem and talk about it in these sort of dry meetings and all of that, it's truly, you know, uncomfortable. All the while, of course, as the conceit of the film is, hearing all of what we
you're
hear.
Just hearing mass extinction.
Right.
This is the thing, right? I think, okay, so if this is part of what interests me about the film, is that looking at it through the lens of, if everybody else is thinking something and everybody else is doing something and everybody else around you is believing something, how hard is it to step out of that line?
Sure.
And say, actually, I don't agree with everybody surrounding me, especially when believing in that something benefits you.
So it's a look at how...
I want to take it a step further and say that what interests me is that he's really good at his job.
Uh-huh.
And it's a lot about work. This film is a lot about work. And it's a lot about... when you're good at your job, and it is chilling to frame it that way, because the film is chilling. It's chilling to frame it that way because the job is just extinguishing people, just mm-hmm. getting rid of people. And so it's really, really horrible. But a lot of it is about how we can kind of fall in line at work, if you will, because it benefits us, but also because everybody else is on the same page, right? Mm-hmm. And it even has that moment where it's it has these moments too where it's like, is, you know, when he's beginning to slip, or when maybe he isn't as good as his job, or he's self-doubting, and all of that is still at play in this way that you could watch this film and just imagine it in the sense of looking at any film about somebody doing a job.
Right.
I don't know. I'm going down a bit of a road with it here, but to me, that's different than the banality of evil, right? That's different than it. I'm not suggesting that that's not somewhere in the threads here, but I think it's so much more complicated than that statement. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think that that's part of what's compelling about it. And it really makes me question not just, I don't know, it makes me question kind of everything, honestly.
Yeah.
It makes me question at times when maybe, you know, some of my own choices at work, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to kind of frame it. It's a disturbing film. I definitely think it. I don't know what I'm trying to say now. But it's definitely turns you inward.
Yeah,
and makes you think about. I think it really puts us. It's a very confrontational film. It really puts us all on the spot, and it really makes you question what you might do in certain circumstances, and think through. I'm not saying that oh, we all have the potential to be Nazis. That's not actually what I'm saying. That actually may be true, but that's not what I'm saying. It can even be brought to something as simple as when you're working through your day-to-day life, some of the decisions that you're making, you could challenge yourself on, truly.
What are you willing to do, or what are you willing to overlook to achieve a comfortable life? And in the United States, sometimes the answer to that question is pretty harrowing. I mean, this is kind of the extreme historical example of that, right?
What is like, systematic capitalism,
sure,
though?
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly it. But, you know.
Like, what is that, right? Like,
yeah.
Are we all willing to – I mean, from the time that we're young, we're sort of directly and indirectly programmed – to think that, like, you look out for yourself,
right?
You do what's best for you. That's the way the system works. And you know, if you're good at your job, you deserve it, and you move up. And so, yeah, I don't know. It's a really, really challenging film especially when you start peeling it back. But I also think that there's a way that you go into this film and you watch this film and you don't even think, and it's still doing something to your brain just by sitting in a seat, and you could go in there completely stoned out of your mind. And without an ability to even grasp a concept, and it's going to do something to your brain.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, great, 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 great movie. A movie that I think has found an audience, too, of people who are willing to take that ride and talk about it and think about it. It is a difficult movie to not walk out of thinking, just turning it over in your head. I mean, it feels like a movie that invites and provokes a great deal of discussion. So see it and join that discussion. I think it's absolutely worth it.
A lot of processing, you know, I mean, yeah. I think that's the other thing too, is that I definitely needed a minute after watching it. I don't know that it's a film that you can sort of like, even though the Sidewalk Cinema is set up to where you go watch a film and then you step out into the lobby and you can have a conversation about the film. This is definitely a film that I think you don't step into the lobby and have a conversation about. I think it's a film that, I mean, you can hear even after having seen it twice and had lots of time to process. I'm still fumbling around exactly how to articulate my thoughts and feelings about the film. So I definitely think it's one that you want to sit with for a while if you haven't seen it yet. And I had some friends that were planning on doing like double feature kind of stuff with it. And I said, you know, I would go to this film and not plan on like a romantic evening afterward.
No.
Right. I would go to this. I wouldn't plan on going to dinner after this. I think this is a like, sleep on it kind of movie.
Well, by the time you're hearing this, of course, we will know whether Zone of Interest has
It's not going to win Oscars. It's not going to win the Academy Award for Best Picture. It's not going to win Best Picture. Brian Rattigan said it. I mean, he was like, this is actually a crazy film to nominate.
I do think it's probably going to win the International Feature Award. Yeah. I do think it stands a pretty good chance at winning that Sound Award. I hope it does.
It better win the sound design, because the sound, Brian also said this, which I thought was just the perfect way to put it. It's a really articulate way to put it, which is that you're watching one film, but you're listening to another one. And that's part of what it's doing to your brain.
Yep.
It is something else on that level. It should definitely win that. I mean, I think it should win Best Picture, but it would be, I just can't imagine that this would be the weirdest Best Picture winner ever. I'm shocked that it's nominated. It is not a kind film, and the Academy really likes kind movies.
It's a good year of nominees. I mean,
it is a great year for nominees.
It's the fact that a movie like that and Anatomy of a Fall, you know, two ambiguous, confrontational to some degree, foreign language to some degree films are nominated for Best Picture.
Both is very cold.
Yeah, it's a good thing. It's a good thing. It's a sign that perhaps that Academy membership is taking their brief of recognizing the best films seriously, not just the best films that
were... you're so optimistic, Corey.
...delivered to me via DVD screener, the best film that Harvey Weinstein shoved down my throat.
That is very optimistic. I mean, look, Poor Things 2 is a film that is not kind.
Killers of the Flower Moon. Really,
Poor Things is such a mean-spirited film, which I love, 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 love. And yeah, Killers is really taking us to task too, isn't it?
Yeah, so, you know, good for them. They made some good choices. Oppenheimer's going to win everything, but good for them.
Anyway, I have a lot of other films. Did you want to mention it? I'm going to hold off because I did spend way too long talking about that. But do you have anything else you wanted to ask?
Yeah, nothing really about Zone of Interest. I will say, like, I had a really great rewatch for my first rewatch since the year it came out of Under the Skin.
Yeah.
Jonathan Glazer's previous film.
I mean, another tricky little film.
And that was a film that when I saw it in 2014, I couldn't really wrap my hands around fully. I knew I was seeing something really great, really considered, but like a lot of it honestly just threw me. This was a fantastic rewatch where I was just like, oh, okay. And maybe it's because I've had a decade to get on this movie's wavelength or whatever, but I was so on board with it this time. And his first two films, Sexy Beast and Birth, are streaming on the Criterion Channel.
Can we just acknowledge that Birth is my favorite film?
Birth, of course, number is your one. Favorite film. Birth is an amazing film. But I do think that, I mean, he is as great of a director as he is. Zone of Interest might be his crowning achievement so far. I hope he doesn't spend a decade in between movies.
It certainly took a lot of time to get together. Birth is still number one on my list of all time.
I mean, that's fair.
It is a perfect film.
Yeah.
It is. I rarely say this about a film, but it is a perfect film.
Great movie. I also watched, in the spirit of the Zone of Interest, the 9.5 hour long Holocaust documentary Shoah from director Claude Lanzmann, which is one of those sort of monuments in world cinema and in documentary that is sort of perpetually on everyone's watch list because of its subject matter, because of its length, because of any number of reasons. Well, we finally bit the bullet and watched it in installments, not in one sitting. That would have been insane. And it's a really difficult watch for many reasons.
Yeah.
But we watched it. I mean, it's totemic, right? It's a monument in the form of a film. So there's not a whole lot to say about it. Other than, you know, it's intriguing that Lanzmann's approach is to let sort of people speak for themselves, to let translators translate on camera. It in some ways, it's a film about listening, right? Because you're not seeing any archival footage. You're just seeing footage of what these places looked like in the 1970s and 1980s when he was making this project, as testimonies play out in voiceover. And those testimonies, of course, are incredibly powerful, including, of course, some of the interviews he's able to acquire through surreptitious means with former Nazi officials and officers. And it makes for a really you know, you'd think at 9.5 hours it would be fairly comprehensive. It doesn't feel comprehensive. It feels intimate. It feels like it only scratches the surface of the great sort of puzzle and horror that was the Holocaust, but kind of essential viewing if you have 9.5 hours to devote to that full project. So I guess that's all I wanted to mention, really, in this segment, because we've gone on a while.
Yeah, we talked about that. Well, we've got more. We obviously watch movies, y'all. So we'll hit you up with what we're watching next time.
That's right.
Or including 3 times from now or something.
Dune
like
Part
that.
2.
Because look how upset
your boy wants to talk about Dune.
I derailed Corey's Dune
relax.
Part 2.
I'm not that upset. Dune Part 2 rules. But there's plenty of, I mean, we'll talk about that for the rest
basically
of the year.
It's basically believe the same me. Film as A Zone of Interest. Basically
no,
the same.
No,
film.
No, it's rather different. But we'll talk about it later. Well, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Side Talks podcast.
We're your own personal cinematic Zachary Ty Bryan and Applebee's. Do you know about this?
No. Did he have a bad meal?
Do you know who Zachary Ty Bryan is?
Of course I do.
Who is Zachary Ty Bryan?
He is the elder son of Tim the Toolman Taylor on the ABC sitcom Home Improvement. Do not come at me with Zachary Ty
Let
Bryan.
Me just tell you. Well, then, if you're so intimate with Zach Ty, you know that he recently had a DUI.
Yes, I actually did know that for some reason.
He did. Recently, apparently, his days on Home Improvement and all those residuals don't keep you from DUIing. So anyway,
they
apparently,
might even encourage it.
They might. Days after the DUI, old Zachary Ty was spotted in the afternoon at the Amigos bar.
Okay.
At the bar. Sat up to the bar, having some beers.
Sure.
And then I want to give him credit.
Uh-huh.
He jumped into a ride share.
Good.
And he headed over to a local Applebee's.
There you go.
And again, sat up to the bar.
Oh, well. Get some nachos too, Zach.
Thanks, TMZ. So are you going to be Applebee's or are you Zachary Ty Bryan?
I'm
going to
be Zachary Ty Bryan. And here's
Zach
why.
Zach Ty Bryan.
Because he is the antagonist, as we all know, in the first 15 minutes of the Fast and the Furious Tokyo Drift, where he challenges Alabama's own Lucas Black to a race through a construction site. And Lucas Black, I think, I don't remember what happens, but they fuck up a lot of the, you know, houses under construction. And Lucas Black gets in so much trouble, he has to go live with his dad in Japan, thus sparking the entire plot of Tokyo Drift.
The drift. Because, you know, cars drift. Oh,
so
man.
You're Applebee's. Congratulations.
I am so happy to be Applebee's. Scrapplebee's. I actually, we're not going to get the sponsorship, let me pre-warn you. The last time I ate it at Applebee's, I thought, is this food? It was one of those like dire trips home where we're like, we didn't want fast food. And we thought like, oh, maybe we could at least get a side of broccoli or like a Caesar salad, you know, and stop at the Scrapplebee's. And we did. And yeah, it was miserable. It wasn't really food. There's no way.
I'm so sorry to hear that.
That's been a couple of years ago. I feel like maybe I'll try it again.
Why? It hasn't gotten better.
I will tell you why, because I want to bring you some menu items.
Okay.
And those aren't always online.
All right. Fair enough.
Chili's baby back real.
Well, if you want to do that to yourself, that's between you and
that's between
yourself.
Me and my Applebee's.
That's
story.
Between you and the Lord, our Lord Applebee's. Thank you to Boutwell Studios.
You know what, Corey? If the Lord didn't want us to eat Applebee's, there wouldn't be Applebee's.
That's true. Isn't that right, Brad?
Praise him.
Thank you for listening, bitches.
Podcast at sidewalkfest.com. And while we're on the subject, visit sidewalkfest.com to get your tickets to see a movie with us at the cinema. Love Lies Bleeding is now playing, and you're going to want to see that because that shit looks crazy. K-Stu, Katie O'Brien, Skulleted Ed Harris. I am so on board.
Nasty.
I am so on board for this grimy looking fucking movie.
Lesbian
so
muscles, bullets,
let's
bullshit.
Let's
fucking go. LFG.
So come see that with us at the Sidewalk Cinema. Those tickets, again, can be found at sidewalkfest.com, and you're going to want to follow us on social media as well at Sidewalk Film. Thanks for listening.
Pretty sure that Kristen Stewart has a style mullet in this, doesn't she?
I think that is the kind
kicking
way.
Kicking it back to that Tegan and Sarah life.
Refer to that. That's
bye.
Right. Bye.
Batwell Studios Podcast Division. Your words, our expertise.